If you follow my work at all, you might know that I'm in the midst of reporting a biography of Tupac Shakur. And this morning, deep on the East Coast, I rented a car and drove 4.5 hours to Elizabeth, New Jersey, to find someone whose address I had, but whose phone number I lacked. And when I arrived, the address was a huge building with a gate around it. And when I made my way to the front door, there was no buzzer. So I stood and I stood and I stood and I waited and I waited, but no one came by to let me in. And the car was due back, and ultimately I left unfulfilled. And while I felt rejected, this is reporting. You have to try and you have to go for it. And as empty as I feel, I'd be 100 times more regretful had I never taken the trip. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Santi Elijah Holly, who is the author of a new book out this week, An American Family, The Shakurs and the Nation They Created. And when I initially learned that someone else was doing a Shakur-related project, I was pissed. But then I met Santi, and I read the book, and he's fantastic, and it's fantastic. So, fuck it. This is episode number 312. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Santi, here we are. And I'm going to open this podcast with something I've never said before, which is, when I initially found out about your book, An American Family, The Shakurs and the Nation They Created, I was very, very angry because
I imagine you would be.
We have the same publisher. I signed a deal to do a Tupac book, and they just didn't really mention the fact that there's another related book in the works. And I was annoyed. I was definitely annoyed. And then they sent me, I asked Maureen, the awesome publicist there, to send me a copy, and she sent me a galley. Number one, I love your book. I think it's great. Number two, it's actually a really good resource for me about the back history of the family. And number three, it's coming out 2 years before my book comes out. And number four, you and I had lunch and you're a wonderful guy. And I hope your book goes on to be a huge seller. I truly do. So all animosity, none of it directed toward you anyway, off the table.
I had the same, reactions in the same order that you had when I heard about your book. I went through the same range of emotions. A little hesitant also about even getting lunch with you that one day. It's like, I don't know where we're going to go with this. If you're going to be angry, if you're going to be, you know, but it was good. And I think that we can help each other. If anything else, we're on the same team.
Yeah. And also, like, we both know how crazy this family is. We both know how hard it is to write a book. Like, it's not easy. So let me start with that. You write about the Shakur family. And for people who don't know, it's this rich, detailed, very long history that involves the Black struggle in America, that involves a wider range of people in the Black Panther movement and the civil rights movement of different categories. Tupac, obviously, his mother, Afeni. What made you even think, I want to tackle this broad, huge, enormous, crazy, dysfunctional, fascinating family unit?
Yeah, I mean, it is very, it's a lot to cover. And as a sort of a lifelong Tupac fan, I'd always known there was something, as you know, many Tupac fans know, there's something about him that just keeps drawing you in. And so as I got older and I started sort of embarking on this career as a journalist and as a writer, I really started doing more work that covered social justice issues and racial justice issues. And somehow I learned more about Tupac's mother, Afeni, and his stepfather, Matulu, and the work that they did before Tupac was a celebrity, before he was a household name. And I really felt like when I tried to learn more about everybody's connections and how they were all tied together, and I kept getting a lot of disinformation or a lot of things that were speculative. I didn't really know, I couldn't really figure out what the actual story was and what the connections were from Afeni, from the Black Panthers to Tupac. So it started as just personal interest of mine. Just, I really wanted to just learn for myself how everybody was connected. And then when I, you know, and there's so much Tupac mythology out there that I really did. It was important to me to not center this book in particular on Tupac. And it was something that I said to, you know, the publisher and to my editor, like at the beginning, in the early discussions, I don't want this to be a Tupac book. And I want it to be a Tupac biography. There will be more Tupac biographies to come, which obviously there are more to come. Like they're just, it's, that is something that I wanted to leave to others to cover Tupac. You know, I'm not a biographer. I'm a journalist. I like to just write about historical events that have influenced, you know, where we are today. So yeah, I don't want to do a whole just straight biography on one person. I wanted to sort of show the times that these people, this family, came up in, and that they were influenced by, that they influenced themselves. Yeah, so yeah, it's broad, and it just it took a lot of just it was like a labor of love, you know. Like I couldn't have done this if I didn't really care about the people involved and what they did, and didn't already have that, like, you know, long interest in Tupac. And so yeah, it was just once I got going, it got bigger and bigger, and just it got to be more important and more broad sweeping than I even anticipated at the beginning.
You actually mentioned something that I find fascinating whenever I'm working on books, which is you called it a labor of love, and you were talking about how important this family is to you, and the family history is to you, and the subject is to you, and having to convince the people you're writing about who are still alive that their stories matter to you, and that you genuinely care about this, and you are living this, and you want to talk to them, not for the financial gain, not for some glorification of self, but because you love this shit and you live for this shit. I find it very hard to do. I find like people are always suspicious and suspect of my motives. Do you feel like you are able to break through to people involved with the family and convince them of your pure motives?
I mean, I'm sure you've obviously come across this a lot, but I came to this as not having much to show. I didn't have any, you know, best-selling books to show as a proof of my, you know, credentials. I had to show articles, magazine articles that I've written that sort of cover a similar topic, you know, similar grounds of social justice and racial justice. And I published an article earlier on Mutulu Shakur and his work in Lincoln Detox. So I just had like little clips. I had little newspaper clippings and magazine clips to show. And then I just had to really come with, you know, I had to come correct. I had to come like with knowledge and just, you know, respect, persistence. I had to really just be like, you know, this is an original story. I'm not just trying to write something that everybody else is, you know, like, because the folks I contacted, you know, they've been contacted for years and years by writers who want to talk about Tupac. And so I was just like, I want to do a bigger story that hasn't really been told. And it's, your story is important to this. Your voice is really crucial to this story. And then I had to just really just convince everybody one at a time. I mean, I had to go through and gain the confidence of one person in the family who then, you know, after we spoke for a while, they could vouch for me to somebody else in the family, you know, sort of just like working my way through one at a time, just like, all right, this person's cool. You should talk to him. You know, he's coming correct. He knows what he's talking about. So I really just had to do a lot of research beforehand. So when I was presented that opportunity, then I didn't, you know, blow it. It took years to even finally get in touch with some people. And like, I was finishing up the first draft, and I would finally get through to a couple people who I've been trying for a long. And I was like, all right, cool. Let me just go back and, you know, let's talk, and I can enter this in. I can plug these quotes in here and there and fix some spots that were a little thin. So yeah, it was just a, you know, it's a labor of love. And also just it's a test of persistence.
This is a nerdy podcast. So I'm curious, like when you are interviewing someone and in the back of your mind, you know that they have the potential to lead you to other people. Does there come a point where you actually say to them, can you put me in contact with so-and-so? And do you worry in doing that you're about overstepping a line and them kind of feeling like they're being used, or you're just, you know?
No. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I usually say that till the end, because usually they'll, you know, they'll ask, I mean, folks will ask, who else have I spoken to? who else have I reached out to? And I'll say who I've spoken to, and I'll say who I am still hoping to talk to. And sometimes, most of the time, they will offer to do that for me. Sometimes I'll ask, hey, I really love to speak to such and such, but I haven't really had any luck. Could you maybe put in a word for me? Or, just like say that you talked to me and that, talk about our conversation, that I was all right. So yeah, that has always, that worked, 9 times out of 10 for me. But I usually save it for the end. After we've already spoken, then I do the either let's follow up again, or the, can you vouch for me? Can you put me in touch with somebody, or can you tell them to get in touch with me if they want to? Yeah, something like that.
Right. You write extensively about Tupac's mother, Fanny Shakur, who obviously is a just fascinating figure. And it's page 55 of your book. You wrote, a young woman who would soon play pivotal roles in the direction of the party and the future of the Shakur family also joined the Harlem chapter at this time. Alice Faye Williams was a 21-year-old former street gang member who had been drifting aimlessly through New York City, experimenting with drugs and looking for purpose. In the spring of 1968, Williams happened upon a Saturday gathering at Harlem's 125th Street and 7th Avenue, a famous corner previously occupied by Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, and several other prominent Black orators. She was halted in her tracks by the assembled crowd, a mix of dashiki wearers, hustlers with processed hair, domestic workers, mothers, and students, all rapped by the speaker, a mustachioed Black man wearing a black leather jacket and a black beret, who was on a recruiting mission from Oakland. Williams' first impression of Bobby Seale, chairman of the Black Panther Party, that was that he was a cute little N-word. But as she listened to him talk about the Panthers' 10-point program, about taking up arms against police repression, and most personal to Williams, about channeling private rage into organized revolutionary action, she realized that this was exactly what she had been looking for. First of all, it's great. Like, great. This book is great. I just want to say, I want to get that out. This is a wonderful.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, yeah. I'm also appreciate you not saying that word. I was wondering, as you're getting close to it, I was wondering.
What would you have said if I did? I mean, what?
I don't know.
When you are researching someone who has been written about a lot, and she has been written about a lot, and she's no longer here to speak for herself, are there certain things you try to find ways you go about it? Are there creative ways of reporting on dead people who have been profiled and chronicled many, many times before?
You know, with the Fanny, it was actually important to me to show her as complete of a person as I could, because I feel like a lot of things that have been written about her historically are always tied to Tupac and mostly focus on her years when she was struggling with addiction, right? Like mostly what you hear about is, you hear a little bit about her days as Black Panther, but you don't really know what she did or what her role was, or like, what her days were like as a Panther, how she joined the party or what she was like before then. And, all we really hear about is just, she struggled with crack and Tupac wrote Dear Mama about her. And that's sort of like, that's the role that she's been relegated to. So I really, I wanted to show that she was a much more rounded person than that. And she had a whole life before her struggles with addiction, even during addiction, even after addiction, like she was still a person who was, she's not defined by her addiction. And I think that over the years, because of Tupac's relationship with her, she's sort of been defined mostly by her addiction. So in writing about her, it was really just, I wanted to cover as much of her influence as I could. And, and here's the thing, when I talk to all the people I talked to, all the people that she worked with in the party, even after the party and when she left, everybody would have almost like exact verbatim stories about her, about how she was, brilliant. She was intelligent. She was forceful. She was passionate, but also that she was stubborn. She was hard-headed. She didn't take any shit. Everybody said the same thing. Like you could get on her bad side and she would chew you out. Down to a person, everybody would say she didn't take any shit. She was a Bronx girl. But she was great. And, I didn't want to, with her and with everybody in the book, I did not want to gloss over or ignore things about people. If that was the truth, if that's what people remembered, that's what people told me about about an individual, whether they were brilliant or they were, you know, stubborn and hard-headed, or they're both in McFeeney's case. I wanted to, you know, just tell that story of a person behind the mythology, you know, just beyond the mythology. Like, this is so, yeah, reporting on somebody who can't speak for themselves, who's not here to speak for themselves. They have people who speak for them. You know, they live on in the memories of people who worked with them, who, you know, who loved them, who battled with them and fought with them. So that's, and then sort of using that along with sort of more historical sources, newspaper archives, writings, books, and everything, just putting that all together to make sort of the most complete person, complete picture of a person that I can.
One thing I found throughout my reporting on the Tupac book is it is really hard to break through this thing, which is the same stories being told over and over and over again until these stories have been told over and over again are the unassailable facts. And they're incredibly hard to crack through. Don't you find that? Like, or maybe you don't. Like, I just think like people tell the same stories over and over again. So Afeni was Panther 21, pregnant with Tupac in prison, becomes a crack addict, Dear Mama, bam, that's the story of Afeni. And it's very hard, at least I find it really hard to crack through and find anything besides this like three paragraph narrative that's been written.
I mean, she deserves, I'm going to say this here and then we'll see which one of us gets to it first, but she deserves a biography of her own. I feel like, cause her yes. story is such big. I mean, even before the Panthers, when she was running around the street gangs, I mean, that's like, that was formative for her. And she, you know, that led her to the Panthers. You know, it wasn't just that she was just living this quiet, sedate life and then just discovered the Panthers out of nowhere. Like that connected to her in a way that it connected to a lot of people that joined the Panthers, that they just were searching for, you know, as Afeni said, she needed a place to channel her rage because she had a lot of rage as a teenage girl. And so this was a place for her to channel her rage and give her purpose and to be a leader. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, sometimes you hear the same stories over and over again, but then you just have to press a little harder because people want, you know, if their go-to stories are the ones that they tell over and over again to people that ask. But, you know, I just found like you just press a little more, you just say, all right, and like, what was she, you know, actually like? What was just her day? Like, how was she as a mother? How does she struggle with, you know, putting food on the table? It's just like, there's a little bit of just, people have those stories in them. And if you just have to just press that, I found, you know, you just press a little more, then they can find some more stories that they have not shared yet with anybody else. You know, some people I talk to really, I've heard these stories for the first time, you know, with some of the interviews I did. Was astounding. You know, it was just like, I've never heard that before. So
yeah. Wait, what would be an example?
So the way that Afeni raised Tupac, I mean, she was so committed to raising him to be the Black Prince of the Revolution, as she said, so that he would carry on the movement, that she would not, she was so strict with him as a kid, just as a boy, that he really, could not do it. So Yasmin Fula, which was a close friend of Afeni's, worked with her in doing sort of rent strikes, tenant organizing, legal services. She told me that Tupac would come around the office that they worked at together. And if young Tupac would ever act out, you know, just get into trouble, just as kids do, Afeni would grab his collar real hard, just twist his collar and say, you know, you won't disappoint the movement. You won't disappoint Black people. So like as a kid, you know, that's a lot to come up with. That's a lot to have in your head of like, all right, like not just you are acting out, but you are disappointing your whole people. Like that's just, you know, and then there's another actually story that Yasmin told me about young Tupac is that when Assata Shakur was on trial, they would, Yasmin would take young Tupac around and drives throughout New York City looking for women on the street, looking for Black women who resembled Assata Shakur. And they would ask this young woman to come back with them to the courthouse to stand in like a police lineup when witnesses would come in and try to identify this particular woman who was, you know, accused of robbing a bank. So they have a witness come in a lineup and they'd have Assata there, then they have three lookalike women. So Tupac would drive around on these these cruises around New York City looking for women that looked like Assata Shakur so they could come in and be like a stand-in for the police lineup. And it's just funny to think about that part of Tupac's growing up, you know, to think like he was really was part of the movement. He was grown to be, you know, he was raised to be thoroughly a part of this movement. And like everybody had a hand in raising. It wasn't just Fanny and Tupac. It was the whole movement. You know, all the comrades were together and raising this boy to be their chosen one.
My last book was about Bo Jackson, right? Bo Jackson. Mm-hmm. My book before that was about the, you know, Shaq Kobe Lakers. Those are not heavy topics, right? Those are, you're going to read this book. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. Maybe you'll learn something, blah, 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 blah. This is a heavy topic, right? This is a heavy topic. You are a black man living in America. You're writing this book. Like Bo Jackson didn't feel like a responsibility to me. It felt like a book that I was doing and the responsibility was to write it really well. Did this book at all feel like does it feel like a responsibility in any way?
Oh man, look, there was a point where I'd been working on this for a couple of years and sort of coming to the finish line, you know, putting on the final gloss on it. And that's when it hit me. And I was like, oh man, like I've been entrusted with all these stories. I've been putting all this work into it. I've been entrusted with these stories. I feel like this heavy weight of responsibility. I definitely did feel like if something goes south here, if I can't get this out, you know, I don't know, for whatever reason or the other, if something happens to me, if something happens to my manuscript, and we lose this, I was really stressed out about it. Cause I was like, I can't lose these stories. This is bigger than me at this point. I mean, not to be, you know, grandiose or anything, but people entrusted me with these stories. And I feel like these are very important stories to share. I mean, like a lot of stories. I mean, even Bo Jackson, his story is really important to share. And, you know, it's just like, it matters to people who are really, you know, who it matters to. It's like some people really take to certain stories and that's their life. And that's what, you know, matters to them most. And for this story, like this is what matters to a lot of people too, but it doesn't make it any less or more worthwhile to people who don't give a shit. But for people who, like myself, who really are influenced by these stories and by these folks and this family, it just became this like, I mean, I want to say a burden, you know, the burden of responsibility, but I was getting a little stressed out that something was going to happen. And you know, I wanted to be educational and informative and inspiring and, you know, enlightening, but yeah, I want it to be entertaining most of all. Like, I want it to be a good, like fun, read where it feels like it's, you know, action packed and people are, you know, engaged by it and riveted. So yeah, I mean, it's like, so I have to sort of get out of get out of my own way, feeling like, oh, this is so important. This is such, it's like, it's not really, it's not like a treatise. It's not a manifesto. You know, it's a book that I really wanted to be. I want it to be entertaining. And I want it to be fun. And I want people to enjoy it. So it's like, you know, once I get out of that whole feeling like it's such like this important, you know, manifesto that I've written that it's going to change the world. Like, I don't know. I want people to enjoy it. It's a book.
You're a pretty soft spoken guy. Do you dread the promotional, the PR element of book promotion? Are you like, that sucks? Or are you okay with it?
I don't know, man. We'll see. I mean, I'm just getting my feet wet now. So I don't mind doing talks and interviews. It's different from writing, as you know, writing is you sit there and you're by yourself and you can take as long as you want to try to say what you need to say. You can craft it and edit it and rework it or throw it away. But this kind of thing, you know, it's like, it is what it is. So you know, it's a different thing than writing, but it's all part of the process. So I'll get hip.
Before we continue with Two Writers Thinking Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my son, Emmett, who's taking the AP test tomorrow. Man, advanced placements are no joke.
Advanced placements? Dad, I take gym, basket weaving, Celtic dance, theories of Kanye West, and the history of cured meat. Do you really think I'm taking advanced placement tests?
So what's the AP?
It's a test sponsored by Royal Retros, the kings of throwback sports merchandise. They want to make sure all their spokespeople at RoyalRetros.com are up to speed.
I don't get it.
AP, Azusa Pacific, where Christian Okoye carried the rock. AP, Anthony Prado, Twins outfielder, batting 152. AP, Arnold Palmer, golf legend. AP.
I'm so confused. Why am I paying your tuition?
Don't worry, Dad. It all goes to my Coke dealer.
All right, I have some random question for you. You work as a freelance writer. You've written for a shitload of places, blah, blah, blah. And you wrote another book called Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds Murder Ballads.
Oh, we're going to go there. All right.
I'm a geek, right? I'm a total geek. And you wrote this book, and it's basically examining the 10 songs on Nick Cave's ninth studio album, Murder Ballads. And you wrote this book, breaking down the songs of the album. I love when authors pursue passion projects that, like, a lot of amazing things would have to happen for a book about Nick Cave's ninth studio album to be, like, the greatest big seller of all time. What made you think, you know what I want my first book to be? I want it to be about Nick Cave's ninth studio album.
It wasn't that intentional that that's what I needed my first book to be. That's just an opportunity that presented itself. You know, I'm a big fan of that particular music book series called 33 and a Third. Sure. And every year they have like an open call for proposals.
Oh.
And I just knew that this, you know, that album, I mean, that's like, I mean, I'm admittedly not the biggest Nick Cave fan. It's not like there are much bigger Nick Cave fans than I am. I listen to his music sometimes. So, and this book, is promoted as a Nick Cave book, but it's really not. It's really about the history of the ballad tradition, specifically murder ballads, and how that has evolved over the years, and how different musicians have taken these old songs and reworked them for modern use and modern times, and using Nick Cave as sort of the backdrop throughout all of this. But it's not a Nick Cave book, which is also it's funny, like American Family is not a Tupac book, even though Tupac is very much sort of the thread throughout it. The Murder Ballads book is not a Nick Cave book, even though Nick Cave is right there in the title. It's just about music. It's about the evolution of folk music, American music. Just using the cave as sort of the thread throughout it all.
Did you enjoy writing it?
I enjoyed writing it as much as I enjoy a lot of things that I've written. It was just like, I enjoy once I've had a good, when I had a good day, writing at the end of the day, I like looking back and being like, all right, that was a good writing day. But I mostly do not enjoy the process of writing itself. That's a nightmare, but I like when I can sit down and close my laptop and, you know, have my first drink of the day and be like, that was a good writing day. All right, I love this. This is good. I like this job.
Where do you write? What's your writing sort of routine?
There's no routine. It's just whenever I'm feeling it. You know, sometimes if I'm working on a book, then I wake up and I have some coffee. Read the news sometimes just to get my brain thinking about words, you know, like just to get in that mindset. I have to read something first just to think about words right. Then I'll have another cup of coffee usually, and then I'll figure out where I'm going to sit, either at my desk or at the kitchen table or on the couch or a coffee shop. Then I just start writing. I write for as long as I can. I don't really set myself a limit. It's just like, I'll shoot for, you know, at best a few hours, 4 hours that, you know, if I go over that, usually whatever I write over that, I end up having to cut later on because it just becomes a mess. Sometimes I write at night, depending on how good I'm feeling about it, how like I'm just like, you know, if I feel like I'm really having a really good writing day, I'll put it away in the morning and then come back to it at night just to keep the momentum going. But I don't have it booked out, you know, like between the hours of this and this, I have to write. I sit down and write. I have to write when I feel like I'm capable of it.
When you did for the Shakur book, would you write as you went along, or do you report for a year or whatever and then have all the material and write?
At first, I spent like 4 months at first just researching, reading a lot of books, reaching out to people. And then I think like after 4 or 5 months, I was just like, I better start writing this thing. I mean, I do have a deadline. Yeah. And, so I took what I had already researched, and that used, and that helped when I finally started talking to people, or at least knew what to say. I knew the history pretty well. So I wouldn't just, you know, that would have been silly for me just to be like, reach out to some, you know, Black Panther elders and veterans and be like, oh, wait, hold on, hold on. Like, walk me back, you know, walk me through everything you're talking about. I had to at least know what I was saying. So when they, you know, when they responded, I knew what they were talking about. I didn't need them to explain everything that they were saying to me, because I mostly knew. I mean, but then they're still, you're always researching, never stop researching. So when I, even through the rest of the time that I spent writing this, I was still reading and still combing through newspaper archives and still doing interviews. It made for slow work, because, you know, I'd have to research and then write and then research while I'm writing. A lot of times I'd be writing and I wouldn't know the answer to something that I was looking for, so I'd have to research it while, like, in the middle of a sentence, you know, in the middle of a paragraph, I'd be like, oh, I don't know where I'm going with this. And then have to stop and then do research, which is really it's a slow way of working, but I don't know. It's the only way I've figured out how it works for me. And then you can go back and change things later on once you have everything done. But yeah, it's just a lot of research as I'm, like, literally as I'm writing, I'm going back and double checking sources and, you know, trying to learn more as I'm going. So it's an arduous process.
I think no matter how one writes a book, everyone can agree, it's just fucking hell.
Yeah, it sucks.
It sucks. It doesn't. Oh, I want to write a book. Really? I want to drill teeth. It's brutal. It's mm-hmm. brutal. It's absolutely. What's your low point? When you're working on a book, what are you at your worst?
If the words are not coming, and you never know when you wake up that day, you know, if the words are going to come or not. I guess that's what I, you know, for me, I just don't know until I sit down and start doing it. And I've had days, you know, I've had many days where the words just aren't coming. None of the words are coming. I can't get anything. I can't even get a paragraph written. And I'm just fighting with it. And then I'm just fighting with it. And it all sounds dumb. And I don't know what I'm saying. And the worst, yeah, the worst is when you have a day like that and you just can't get out of it. It's not even like, you know, I don't really know if I believe in writer's block. It's not like it's a block, you know, because it can come and go at will. There's no real, like, rhyme or reason to it. But when it happens, when there's just a bad writing day, I feel like I really have to just force my fucking way through it, you know, just like, I don't know, I have to finish this. I can't just, you know, there's times where I don't know what's ever happens to you, where I'm just want to just scrap it, just say, fuck it, give back my advance and say, I'm done. I'm sorry. I you know, sorry, y'all, it's not happening.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, if you have enough bad writing days, I feel like I'm not the one to do this. I can't do it. I'm sorry I let everybody down, but here's your advance back. No hard feelings. I'm going to go off and, you know, try to get another job altogether. So, yeah, I just had to fight my way. I don't have any other options besides this. So this is all I got to do.
There are times when I'm sitting in a coffee shop and I see the barista and I think, I just want that job. Like, I just want that job. I want that job where I make coffee and I talk to people. And, oh, you don't like you want more sugar in that? Okay, I can do that. Let's refill that. And then come 6 o'clock, I go home and I watch TV. That's mm-hmm. every now and then I have that true, not bullshitting, that true feeling of like the, what must be a really nice feeling of completing a job and being like, okay, I'm done for the day. Going home, knowing tomorrow you can do, there's going to be nothing, no drink you can't make, nothing I can't accomplish. And then going home, like, this job, you don't turn this off. Like, that to me is the worst part of this job. You don't turn it off.
Right, right. I mean, look, I don't know what your occupational background is, but I've worked a lot of shitty jobs. Just, I've been that barista. I've been that bar back, that line cook, working in delis, you know, short order cook, you name it. Like, you know, I worked at a bookstore for many years, which was not so bad, but still.
You worked at Powell's, right?
I worked at Powell's, yeah, that little bookstore. And I gotta say, you know, even with everything, even at the worst, my worst writing day, I still never want to go back to that. I never want to go back to working a retail job or a food service, you know, food industry job. I did it for so long, and I would rather be accountable to myself. And if I'm having a bad day, that's on me, not on the customers or the boss. Even at the worst, I would not give this little weird occupation up that we have for ourselves.
Wait, it's actually funny. I had dinner recently with Jonathan Eig, this author. He has a new MLK book coming out. And I kind of said the same thing. I was like, don't you ever look at someone just working a job where you don't have deadlines and blah, blah. And he actually was like, he was almost offended by the thought. He's like, I'm getting paid to get a PhD on Martin Luther King and write this biography that people are going to read, and it'll hopefully go down as a thing. He's like, I don't envy the barista. I've worked those jobs. You've worked those jobs. Right? You're actually right. Like we are in a very cherished spot being able to do this for a living and being able to do it for a living. I just sometimes lose my mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. That's to be expected. I mean, that just means that we're, I don't know what it means. It just, you know, there's nothing I'd rather do. I mean, maybe I'd rather do nothing. I guess if that was an option, I'd rather do that.
You'd be bored after a while. Wait, what's your worst career experience? Non-writing, lowest career experience.
When you say career, it makes it sound like I'm thinking of work experience. My lowest work experience.
Yeah.
I've had so many. I mean, I worked at this place. What was it called? That was probably 19, 20. I think it was called Tubby's. It was a sub shop in Ann Arbor, Michigan, like on campus. We grilled meat on this hot stove, like it's hot, you know, just like we had this hot grill. We had to grill this meat, and it's just so fucking greasy and hot. And you had to clean out the grease trap, you know, every day, and it would just spill over everything and just get all on the floor and your shoes. And take it out to the back to dump it into this big grease dumpster. And we got paid shit. And like, it was just the shittiest. It was just, I feel like, and I think sometimes I think back to that. I mean, obviously, like, that's my go-to when I'm like, as bad as it gets, you know, writing is, not, is sometimes if the words aren't coming, if I get a bad review, I'm not spilling hot grease on my shoes night after night. So that's, you know, as long as I'm not, let's have to put things into perspective, I suppose.
I had a job at the Jefferson Valley Mall in Yorktown Heights, New York, where I walked around with a clipboard and needing people to take surveys. And I was like 18 years old. I was already like a fragile teenager who couldn't take rejection. And that job was just nonstop rejection. Like everyone, no, 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 no. And it turned me into a puddle of absolute shit. So I think people need those jobs. I think having grease spilled on your shoes, I think getting rejected over and over again, I think there's something important developmentally about having those experiences.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I tried doing those jobs. Was it like, cold calling jobs where you talk, you know, I lasted a day. I'm like, I'm out of 2 minutes. I can't handle people hanging up on me.
It was like bad enough that no girl would talk to me at school. And now I'm getting rejected by like their parents at the Jefferson Valley Mall. It's terrible. Wait, so I mentioned you do a lot of freelance work, and you have just a fascinating, dizzying buffet of articles throughout your career and different stories and topics. And I found one that just like did it for me.
Oh no.
You wrote this in 2020. For Level, and it's the headline is "He's Black, Orthodox Jewish, and a Dope Ass Rapper." Seattle-born Nassim started out as a black gangster disciple, then it became a disciple of the Torah, which I love.
Okay, first of all, that is such a great the headline itself. Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't care about that, but that subheader, the disciple of the Torah, like black gangster disciple to disciple, that was pretty brilliant. The editor who came up with that, that was a good one.
It's great. And your lead, I just want to say, a trap beat fills the air, an African chant winding its way among the drum and bass. On the street, two groups of men approach each other, one in contemporary streetwear, the other clad in African dress and ornaments. The crews bump chests, ready to throw hands, but then yet another group appears to break up the impending battle, dressed in traditional Hasidic garb. A stocky black man appears on the screen. He's wearing the furry Steimel hat and swaying tzitzit tassels of the Hasidic Jew. He's also spitting absolute fire. He said it's God's plan, but I'm God's man, he raps, shouting out fellow Jewish rapper Drake. This is Nassim Black, or as he calls himself a few moments later, Hitler's worst nightmare. And then he wrote, Shalom, y'all.
I thought that Shalom, y'all was going to get cut, but they kept it in.
Oh, it's a nice cut.
It was just kind of over the top. I was like, whatever. It's a fun article. It's not like, you know, it's too serious, not too deep. So it was just, let's just have fun with it. But
yeah, how'd you find out about this guy? How'd you even know this guy existed?
I don't know. Somewhere I'd read about him. Oh, I think some little like notice that he had this music video premiere on some music website. I love hip hop music, but I also respect when somebody is willing to embrace their Judaism, their heritage, their faith. It doesn't have to be Judaism, doesn't have to be Christianity, it can just be whatever the faith is. But in something like hip hop, where you can't really do that openly, or at least we're not, you know, hip hop artists aren't really expected to profess their faith in Judaism, especially because there's such a divide between Judaism and like Black America. But with hip hop and with this guy, I just saw it and I was just immediately drawn to it. I was just like, what's this guy talking about? What's his story? And then, yeah, I was like, I want to learn more about him. And so I just contacted him. I reached out to him and I was like, you want to just chat? You know, I want to write this profile on you, learn your story. I mean, that's the way most of the articles that I've published, they're very wide ranging. They're sort of all over the place. There's no real like single thing that is like, this is my beat. I just write about shit that I want to write about, you know, that things that interest me. I'm just like, oh, write about, you know, like exorcism. I followed an exorcist on a home exorcism. Sure, I'll do that. I, you know, flew to Georgia to hang out in a little commune of pecan farmers for whatever reason, Christian pecan farmers. Okay, Orthodox Jewish rapper, sure, why not? So it's just like, I don't know, I'll just write about, I learn about something, I see something in the news that sparks my interest, I'm like, fuck it, let's just see who wants to publish this, and then I'll just do it. I don't know, it's just all vibes. It's all whatever I want to pursue on any given day.
You wrote something I found just really intelligent and interesting, which is you wrote, Judaism has long gone unrecognized and unacknowledged in hip hop. Despite the Jewish heritage of many white MCs, from pioneers like MC Search and the Beastie Boys, contemporaries like Action Bronson and the late Mac Miller, Judaism itself is rarely spoken about. When Black rappers mention Jews, it's often as lawyers, bankers, and other age-old stereotypes. And while you could argue that Jadakiss's stacked chips like Hebrews or Jay-Z's You Ever Wonder Why Jewish People Own All the Property in America are harmless language, it still exposes tensions between the two communities.
That Jay-Z line, and like, it tripped me out that nobody really pushed back on that. I mean, that's a very blatantly, it's a blatant statement to, you know, yeah, to say that. And everyone was like, oh yeah, like that's cool, it's Jay-Z. But no, there's no pushback on that. And I was astounded.
Well, I'm kind of interested. Like, I've been going through this myself with Tupac. Like, when I first started researching this, someone said to me, you're going to have a lot of problem writing this book. And I said, why? And they said, well, because you're a white sports writer, emphasis on white more than sports writer. Like, you're a white guy and you're coming into this universe. And what I've actually found, I have to say, is kind of the opposite. Like, I feel like people have been incredibly open. I really have. And I feel like if you know your shit, people respect that. And if you come in and you show that you did your research and you know your things, as I learned when we had lunch, your mom is Jewish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you come into the story writing about a Black Jewish rapper. You're a Black man who's Jewish. Does that allow you to write about this in a certain way that, I don't know, a white Christian guy couldn't, or no?
I mean, it's the whole question, a whole debate of who's allowed to write whose stories. And, you know, it's look, like you said, like if you are knowledgeable and if you are interested in the story, like I'm black and Jewish, but really non-practicing and really non-observant. So does that give me any?
You're
more?
Counted anyway. We I take know. Anybody. You know, we take yeah. anybody.
Well, not anybody, but anybody.
Literally anybody.
But you know, somebody like Nassim, this rapper who converted. He wasn't born Jewish. He converted at a later age, and he is Orthodox. And so it wasn't like I approached him. I didn't write him and say, oh, by the way, Nassim, I am also Black and Jewish. So therefore, you know, I'm the right person to tell this story. I just said, you know, I'm interested in the story. I think it's an important story. I really want to learn more. in our conversation, it came up, but it wasn't like, you know, I had to use that as leverage. And I don't think that is really necessary. I mean, I think it's more about just showing the knowledge and the respect to your subject. Yeah. It depends how you tell the story. If you tell the story as if the, you know, you are the person that should be telling the story, you know, maybe that's not so. But that's just sort of like, it's this gray area of like who can tell whose stories. I think it's just, you know, if you tell it right, you tell it right. But and some people will obviously be. I think even in your case, you know, maybe there'll be some people like the older folks, the older movement people who might take pause at you being the one to approach them, to write the story. But with Tupac, because Tupac, his fans, the people who really embrace him today and have always embraced him, you know, been his fans, like he's had many, many, many white, not just fans, but, you know, biographers and champions, enthusiasts. He's sort of, I mean, yes, he's a child of the Black Liberation Movement. He spoke about issues of racial justice and police brutality in the Black community. He was in every sense, he was a Black man. He's a Black entertainer. But, you know, he can be approached so many different directions, in so many different ways. It doesn't have to be this one. I'm writing about Tupac's Blackness. You know, if you were like, you know, that's, you're writing about Tupac, the person, the man, right? So like, and he was, as you know, he was very complicated and conflicted. And that's the story, that's, you know, that's the story about Tupac, is like all those contradictions that he held within himself. And so that's not something that's like, you know, unique to one person or the other, or one race or the other, or one, you know, religion or the other. It's just like, if you come at it with like a knowing this and having respect for and having open mind, and that's that, you know, then that's, I feel like, all you should really be concerned about. So yeah, I mean, as a Black Jew myself, as a adherent of the Torah, I write about Christian faith, and I write about, you know, but I'm not really of one particular faith or denomination, but I just am a pretty knowledgeable person. And so I, you know, I'm just approach everything as a student, as somebody who wants to learn more. And I think that's all you can really ask.
Let me ask you a final question. You alluded to this earlier. February 21st, 2018, you wrote a piece for the Portland Mercury, an excellent day for an exorcism.
We're going back. You dug into the archives.
Hey, what's what I do? Accompanying an exorcist on a home cleansing. That was a subhead. And, you know, it's self-explanatory. You accompanied an exorcist on a self-cleansing. And you wrote, you went with this guy, Bishop Cloud, and he was performing an exorcism. And you wrote here, okay, Bishop Cloud continues. So tell me if any of these symptoms of an attachment apply. A lot of anxiety, depression, mood swings, such as anger coming out of nowhere, poor relationships, like a black cloud follows this person. Do any of those sound familiar? Yes, Stan responds right away. Okay, Bishop Cloud says, then she has an attachment. There's a long pause as Stan takes this in. And I love, this is where you're right. You wrote, at this point, I feel like I should interrupt to point out that these symptoms sound a lot like those of any young woman in her early 20s or anybody at all, really. But what do I know? This is my first exorcism. This story is fantastic. At the end of the exorcism, were you like, this is just utter bullshit? Or are you like, oh,
I got to be careful with every once in a while. So yeah, this was, I mean, the kind of a little bit of the backstory was that, yeah, this father of a young woman felt like his daughter was attached by demonic spirits or whatever. And so he hired this exorcist to come into the house when she was gone and to go through her stuff and go to her bedroom and cleanse her and whatever. It's yeah. And so when I was there with them throughout this whole thing, and it was not what I expected an exorcism to look like. I mean, as I said, it's my first exorcism. So I don't know. You picture like spinning heads and beds levitating off the ground. But this was like a strangely just therapeutic thing where the father just was going through so much personal anxiety that his daughter was possessed by devils. And the exorcist himself, Bishop Cloud, was just kind of performing a lot of rituals. And whether or not it's bullshit, you know, it's like, you can say that same thing about any sort of about exorcisms or about anything like that is like, sure. It's bullshit if it's, if you're really just trying to take advantage of the person, like, you know, if Bishop Cloud was really just putting one over on this guy, but the exorcist, Bishop Cloud, he works for free. You know, he drove for like 2 hours just to be there. He really believed that he was helping this guy. This guy really believed that he needed help. You know, this is one of those few articles that I write about myself and my opinion, and I'm there. I'm participating as an observer. I was just like, this is strange to me. I don't really think that this is, it's not my call to make, you know, I'm not going to jump. That's why I didn't interrupt. I'm just going to stand back and watch this unfold. And at the end, you know, we all went home. We all went our own ways. I was just like, I'm not really sure what I just witnessed here. Like, I'm not sure if anything happened. Maybe I just didn't see it. Maybe I wasn't looking closely enough. Maybe I was too cynical to really see what was going on. But people after that article was published, so that's the thing is, like, I wrote it and it seems a little like, you know, it seems a little jokey and, you know, it seems like I'm kind of making fun and a little like teasing and poking at this guy a little bit. But after that article was published, people reached out to me, people emailed me, strangers, you know, emailed me from all over Oregon. They were like, hey, I think I might be having an attachment issue. Could you give me Bishop Cloud's number or his contact info? Like, I really would like to, you know, I read your article and I think that I really need his help. I was like, are you serious? You read that and you still felt like this was something that you wanted to pursue? Like, all right, yeah. So I didn't want to, like,
right.
I was like, yeah, I'm happy to share you with you. I don't want to be like, no, it's all bullshit. Don't bother. I was like, no, if that's what you think you need, by all means.
Is it true or false, that for every person who buys a copy of An American Family, The Shakurs and the Nation Created, you will go to their house and perform an exorcism?
I'll do that anyway. I'll, you know, burn some incense. I'll say a few ritualistic prayers over your, you know, whatever you need.
Right.
I'll throw in a book for free too.
No, can't throw in the book for free. You have to buy the book to get the exorcism.
All right.
Put my foot down here. Well, Santi, first of all, thank you for doing this. It's a great book. I'm glad we become friends over this. You know, we were going to throw down, but instead we become.
I was ready to fight, and so was other people close to me. So,
but you know, so
glad we worked it out.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for doing this, and you know, best of luck with the book, obviously.
Yeah, and best of luck with your book and your research, and I look forward to reading that.
I want to thank today's guest, Santi Elijah Holly, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. You can follow Santi on Twitter at Santi Holly, and buy An American Family, The Shakurs, and The Nation They Created wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really grateful. Music is by the Soda Can-ish MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.